From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
Even in the beginning in 1968, I had over 600 Catholic theologians in this country agreeing with me, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've never been the lone wolf. I've never been the voice in the wilderness.
Dissent. Organized religion has responded badly to it over the millennia, variously shunning, excommunicating, imprisoning, torturing, and even killing those who threaten its authority. For the Catholic Church, one prominent theologian has been a thoughtful source of dissent for five decades, and the story of Father Charles Curran has many fascinating layers. This week, you'll hear part two of my very special conversation with the man who literally wrote the book on loyal dissent.
$10,000, that's how much money people in Texas can now win in court by successfully suing anyone who helps a woman get an abortion after 6 weeks. There are no exceptions under this new law for rape or incest.
They say everything's bigger in Texas. And these days, that includes the magnitude of state house assaults on reproductive freedom, voting rights, and local government control. The struggle to resist is daunting, but that doesn't keep faith-driven activists from trying their best. We'll get the latest from Texas Freedom Network organizer, Reverend Angela Williams.
Look, I didn't have a lot of things that my Western friends had. I'm sure a lot of you can relate to this, you know, like the Easter Bunny and bacon bits. I never got to see my mother's face. Things like that.
It's always tricky to try to quantify something as nebulous as humor. But humor is also a telling aspect of culture and identity. And so the study of what makes humor Muslim can tell us a lot about both. On this week's show, you'll meet a scholar who's taken a look at this topic and been recognized with a national award for doing so.
I'm Ray Kirstein at the intersection of religion, politics, and showbiz. The much-vaunted mass return of anti-democratic forces to our nation's capital this past weekend turned out to be mostly smoke and mirrors, or at least TV cameras. With more journalists on hand than actual protesters, it was one hopeful sign in the swirling morass of post-truth fog and confusion that the, quote, Justice for J6 rally engineered by a former Trump campaign operative failed to draw much attention from the fever swamp. Meanwhile, the political religious rights push for cultural dominance and the undermining of our secular democracy continues with the next installment of the propaganda movie, God's Not Dead, the next chapter, We the People. With a release date of October 4th, this is the latest attempt to capitalize on the box office success of the original film, which brought in $65 million in 2014. It's also being pushed by political religious right mobilization groups such as the Mike Huckabee-fronted My Faith Votes. And Religion News Service reports that a growing number of newly hatched fundamentalist Mormon communities nationwide are adopting as core to their doctrine the discredited and destructive claims of QAnon conspiracy theorists, fueled by the fears and confusion endemic to the ongoing COVID-19 crisis. Recent reports from the Public Religion Research Institute show that white evangelicals, Hispanic evangelicals, and Mormons are the religious groups most vulnerable to Q-spiracies.
Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you so much for doing so. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now to our first guest. Over the decades, the issues have changed. In the 1960s, it was contraception. Later, it was premarital sex. divorce, homosexuality. But one constant in the modern history of the Catholic Church in this country has been the thoughtful, articulate dissent from church doctrine by Father Charles Curran, now professor of human values at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. I'm very pleased to welcome Charles Curran to State of Belief Radio. Charlie, thank you so much for being with us today.
Welton, it's my pleasure to be with you.
How important is church history in the arguments that you've made over these decades?
Well, that I think you're in the wrong vocation. You should be a Catholic theologian. Because right here you are exactly pointing into the primary issue. And the primary issue is precisely that of historicity, historical development, and historical consciousness. And the danger in Catholic thinking was that there were things that were always and everywhere the same. That the old Catholic hymns and prayers always ended per omnia saecula saeculorum, through all the centuries until the end. Well, that this historical change is so different. And in fact, one of my teacher, Father Bernard Lonergan, when he was asked what took place in Vatican II, why did Vatican II change so much in the Catholic Church? And his answer was precisely yours. He said, historical consciousness. And historical consciousness is distinguished from what he called classicism. Classicism believes in the eternal, the immutable, and the unchanging. I'm looking out the window here at my institution over you, and every one of our buildings is built in the classical architectural form. We've got those Ionic, Doric, and Corinthian columns that go way up. They're solid. They're permanent. They're not going to change. Huh? That was Greek architecture. Mm-hmm. But look at contemporary architecture. You know, I mean, the buildings are no longer square. They're all over the place. Huh? I mean, that's just a quick illustration here, that this historical consciousness says that change and development takes place, and that we have to recognize that and deal with it. Mm-hmm. And that was really what my professor Bernard Lonergan said way back in the 60s, that it's that historical development has always occurred within the church. Mm-hmm. In fact, again, learning from Lonergan, I used to say when I first taught in the seminary, you know, St. Peter would have flunked a first grade catechism exam. You'd ask him, how many persons are there in the Trinity? He'd say, what are you talking about? What is a person? What's a Trinity? Those were all concepts that the church learned in the 4th and 5th centuries. Yeah. You know, it's amazing how much development has occurred in the Catholic Church. Huh? But the problem was that, especially from the Reformation on, the Catholic Church was defensive. It was, its understanding of the church was triumphal. We never change. We have the truth, and we're not going to change one bit. Well, that's not true. That's not what the Catholic Church has been over the centuries. Yeah. Yeah. And as I say, once you have a sense of history, mm-hmm. you realize how much change has occurred, mm-hmm. and why it's absolutely necessary that change must continue to occur. Mm-hmm. Now, again, that doesn't mean that any change goes kinds of things, huh? But it does mean that as I said before, we've always got to, you know, believe that God is love. Mm-hmm. But when you get down to it, well, what does love mean? And interestingly enough, even within the New Testament itself, there are various understandings of love. That, for example, the Synoptic Gospels say the great example of love is love of people in need, love of the poor, love of enemies. Yeah. That's what you have to do. But what does John's Gospel say? Love one another as I have loved you. Mm-hmm. As the Father loves me, and I love the Father, so you people in the church must love one another. It's the love of the sisters and brothers. But that's because he was dealing with a particular problem in the early church where the church people were fighting one another. So to get them to avoid that, John's Gospel says, love one another. Let's get rid of all these divisions and stuff in the church kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, these differences have always been existing, in other words.
You gave us an insight into the conflict at Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., related to contraception. You spent 2 decades there, so I know that was a place of home. Were you known as the relentless critic, or would that be an exaggeration?
I think an exaggeration, because I mean I was a. In fact, when I left, or when I was thrown out, you might say, of Catholic University, my faculty colleagues took me out to dinner, and we had a nice celebration. And they said, "Well, how do you feel?" And I said, "This is tough for me. I mean, I found here a home. I found people who shared thoughts with me. I just hope I can find that same thing wherever I go in the future. But I'm going to miss this, and miss it very much, despite the problems." Mm-hmm. So that, I think, goes back again to that distinction I made, or I didn't make, but that the Catholic Church has made, between those teachings that are core and central to the church and those that are further peripheral and removed. Mm-hmm. And I have not challenged that. I believe that Jesus is God, I have not challenged it. I mean, that means quite a bit to me. I mean, I wish my prayer life was better than it is, but I still try to work on it.
Mm-hmm. What were your greatest sources of satisfaction from your time at Catholic University?
I think the greatest source was the positive reception from colleagues and students. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, to this day, I still have people call me or write me and say, I appreciate so much what you taught me, et cetera, how you opened my eyes, how you got me to see there was a different way of looking at things. And maybe that's the great joy of anybody who's a teacher.
Yeah.
It's your students. And that you feel that you've done something, and especially your students and your colleagues. I mean, that there's, in fact, this is interesting. The other day in my course here, the undergraduates of this Methodist institution, that I reminded them that in our library, we had a magnificent library here, and we have a 1577 volume from Bishop Antoninus of Florence, and where he talks about the obligations of various states of life. But he says the first obligation of physicians is to be competent. And as I say, to me, and he said, the best judge of competency is, in fact, here's this guy. I love him. He's a little small guy. And he said, well, some people say you're competent if you've graduated from a university. And I say to my students, what do you see in every doctor's office? Degrees, right? They're plastered all over the place. Now, also, though, they never tell you what the grades were, but at least they tell you they graduated. Huh? Yeah. But Antoninus's point was marvelous. He said, look, I've spent my life in universities. I've taught there. I've studied there. And I know there are a lot of people in universities who aren't competent. Hmm. The best judgment of competency is judgment by peers. Hmm. And that's what my peers have done for me, frankly, huh? It's that judgment that has made me feel that, yes, I have done what I should have done, and I've been supported in it.
After so many years at Catholic University, what happened in 1986?
Well, part of the Catholic Church's reality and problem is it's living in the past. And it took that long to finally get me from 1968 to 1986. Huh? And the Pope said I was not suitable to be a Catholic theologian. And then there was some battles going on within the Catholic University about it. But the and I took them to court when they said I lost my tenure. I said, you can't take it away from me. Well, in the end, the District Court of Columbia said no. There was nothing in my contract or any other faculty member's contract at Catholic University that would demand that if the Vatican said someone was no longer a Catholic theologian, that there was nothing in my contract that said that the university could not accept that judgment. That was the case.
Ah. Well, and that had repercussions all through academia, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. And I mean, again, the whole role of Catholic universities and what is the role of Catholic universities? And I have been a strong supporter of the need for academic freedom in Catholic higher education. And again, academic freedom says, that you have to, that the faculty member has to be free to express positions on subjects, et cetera. But again, the professor, she has to be competent. Mm-hmm. And again, competency is determined by judgment by peers, not by outside people, but by your peers. Yeah. And but this only came into Catholic university life in this country, frankly, in 1960. It began in 66, 7, and 8, actually. I mean, this was a strong, very recent development that, comparatively speaking. Mm. But, I mean, that Catholic higher education accepted the norms and principles of the American higher education and what is called the American Association of University Professors.
The Vatican still challenges your right to teach Catholic theology. That just blows my mind. Charlie, what is the very real damage done to Catholic theology by silencing dissent or discussion? What does the church lose, and what do the faithful lose?
I think, that it's a terrible loss, but very bad loss. But the reality is there are many people, I'm no longer the voice in the wilderness. As I said before, even in the beginning in 1968, I had over 600 Catholic theologians in this country agreeing with me kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've never been the lone wolf. I've never been the voice in the wilderness. That my position, it might not be, accepted by the Catholic in the pew kind of thing, but by Catholic theologians, it's a well-known teaching.
Yeah.
In fact, just a little story. I, was in the midst of that 1968 thing. I was walking in Washington and ran into a bishop whom I knew. And I said to him, well, I suppose you're not very happy with what I'm doing. And he said, no, Charlie. He said, I taught the seminary. I know the difference between infallible and non-infallible teaching. You're not saying anything different. Now, you know, not all the bishops, you know, would agree with him. But, yeah. I mean, I was sort of amazed when he said, no, it doesn't bother me at all.
Yeah. What are the voices that you most worry about being silenced today, both within and beyond the church?
Well, quite frankly, that I don't think that anybody is going to be silenced by church authority anymore. I mean, let's face it. There were very few cases after mine. There were a few. But no one ever had as severe a penalty as I had, kind of thing. Hans Kung and myself, but nobody else. And I think now, I mean, people realize that's just not going to happen anymore. And it hasn't happened. And so I think that's to the good. Now, on the other hand, you know, there is the quiet side. I mean, I'm never invited to take part in any, you know, official Catholic groups. I used to go, you know, there were bishops' commissions I would serve. I don't have any official role like that. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you know, I probably have a much more important role mm-hmm. to play in the total people of God.
Yeah.
There was a cartoon in, I forget where it appeared. I don't think it was the Times, but it was right after 1968. And the Pope is saying, whatever happened to that American Catholic theologian that I silenced? And then there's a picture of me with 100 or 20 microphones in front of me, kind of thing. I mean, in the end, you know, their action probably went against them, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the ironies of life, let's sure. say.
Huh? Do you worry that powerful conservative forces in the church are aligned against Pope Francis, the same forces that used to always say dissent was heresy?
I am very worried about that. And frankly, I think that the Pope himself is worried about it. Now, I have written that, and I don't think Pope Francis is ever going to change one of these teachings that I disagree with. Mm-hmm. But he has invoked what again is a traditional old principle, and it came up very well when he was talking about gay relationships. And they, coming back from one of his trips on a plane, they asked him about it, gay relationships, and he said, "Who am I to judge?" Mm-hmm. That we've always said that the internal disposition of the heart is where sin resides, not in the external act itself.
Yeah.
So he's not going to go as far as I want him to go, but he's going to move, you know?
Yeah.
And that's why some of the conservative voices in the church are not happy with what he's doing.
Sure.
I mean, the poor Pope, I mean, that's a terrible role to play.
Yeah.
And this cartoons, you know, humor is important. I always say that the two great signs of transcendence that get you out of the present are prayer and humor.
Yeah, right.
And mm-hmm. right after the reaction to the encyclical of 68 and our reaction against it, there was a cartoon in the New Yorker, and it had three people in a room. I don't know, De Gaulle was one of them. The president or the prime minister of England and the president of the United States, and they're they're talking about their problems. And there's a knock on the door, and it's Pope Paul VI. And they say, oh, welcome to the club. That's why I say humor and prayer are the great signs of transcendence.
Charlie, as you look back across your career, is there one regret that stands out for you? Is there something you wish you had done or wish you had not done with the benefit of hindsight?
Yes, but I think, in a sense, sure. Well, I could have taught this course better. I could have responded better to your questions today than I have. One sense, the perfect is the enemy of the good. Mm-hmm. And none of us is perfect. We've all made all sorts of mistakes. But I must say, in terms of the general things that I have done, I'm in good conscience. I've satisfied myself that I think I did what I should have done. Mm. And we've always said, interestingly enough, in the Catholic Church, the sign of a good conscience is the peace of conscience.
Yeah.
And, what else could you ask for?
What would you say to someone contemplating loyal dissent in the structures they find themselves in? Why risk career, opportunity, reputation?
Well, first of all, because in my ethics, I'm opposed to what they call consequentialism, that says that the only thing that counts in making a judgment is what are the consequences of the act. I think you got to do what you think is right, no matter what the consequences are. And I think that's what I tried to do. Today, there are many people who dissent to the church today. Look at all the divisions. In fact, yesterday I had a conversation with the president of our university, and something came up about the problems, within the university. And he looked at me and he said, well, look at Charlie. The problems of the Catholic Church are much bigger than the problems within our university.
After all these years, why are you still a Catholic? And why are you a Catholic priest?
Okay. First of all, it's because everything I have said, I am convinced of the Catholic Church as being a true, with all its problems, that is an important way. I'll put it this way: not the only way, but an important way in which God works in this world, and that I have been the benefit of that. To me, it's an important thing to recognize that there is a Redeemer in this world, that people can have hope. Look at what's going on in the world. Look at what's going on in the churches. But there's so many problems. There's so much difficulty. And I'm afraid even with our young people, they're losing hope. And I agreed so much with St. Paul. If you see it in front of you, it ain't hope. hope, as the scripture says at times, it's like the farmer that puts the seed in the ground and it's growing there, but you never see it till the end. Yeah. And that hope, I think, is the most important Christian virtue there is. And we all need hope in the situations in which we live, the situations of our churches, our world, etc. So it seems to me then that if I had to stress anything, that it's the church that has always taught me the vital importance of hope, and that this is a promise of God that ultimately God's love will overcome all obstacles. My sinfulness, my crazy things, my mistakes, but also the broader mistakes of the world, the suffering, the whole evil that's going on in the world, that's one of the great benefits that we are people who can have hope. That doesn't mean we don't get discouraged. That doesn't mean we don't have bad days. But it does mean that there's something that we can't see that we believe is at work.
Father Charles Curran is professor of human values at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. He tells his story in the powerful memoir, Loyal Dissent, Memoirs of a Catholic Theologian. Charlie, I firmly believe that the hope for our future as a species, as a culture, and as people of various religious and non-religious orientations lies in the hands of loyal, loving, faithful, courageous dissenters. I often think, where in the world would we be right now in progressive religion if we had not had dissenters that helped open our eyes? The status quo is not working. It's been an honor to visit with you today. I thank you for all you've done to lead and to challenge, and I thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, I appreciate this hour. It was a great honor for me to be a part of it. I apologize for this terrible cold I have right now, but I enjoyed it very much, and thank you for giving me this opportunity.
You can view the entire conversation on our website at stateofbelief.com. There's lots more still ahead. Up next, how the Texas Freedom Network and its allies are working to push back against unprecedented attacks on a women's right to choose. And later, studying what makes humor Muslim. If you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. On September 1st, the hyper-busy Texas state legislature passed just one of the many extremist laws that we've seen this session. It's no wonder Democratic lawmakers spent 6 weeks in exile in a last-ditch attempt to defend democracy in their state earlier in the session. Despite making up barely 30% of the state's population, white evangelical Christians seem to be the only ones whose values matter anymore. The Texas Freedom Network is at the forefront of this seemingly endless game, and it does a great job bringing together diverse people of faith as well as other concerned Texans. The Reverend Angela Williams is Senior Outreach and Faith Coordinator at TFN, and their project, Just Texas, Faith Voices for Justice, and I am happy to have her with us again on State of Belief Radio. Angela, welcome back.
Thanks, Welton. It's really good to be back with you here on State of Belief.
The bill was signed into law at the start of this month. What makes this stand out even among the many other state anti-choice laws that we've seen proliferating?
Yeah, I want to clarify one thing. It was signed back earlier in the summer, but went into effect September 1st.
Okay.
And so SB 8 is a 6-week abortion ban. And this means that there are no abortions can happen in the state of Texas after fetal cardiac activity is detected, which typically happens around 6 weeks of the gestation. But honestly, most people don't even know that they are pregnant at that time. Mm-hmm. Now, we've seen similar bills to the 6-week abortion ban coming up in Republican-led states across the country. But what makes SB 8 particularly heinous is that it takes enforcement of this law out of the hands of the state and into private citizens' hands, which sets up this sort of vigilante legal system where anyone anywhere can sue anyone who, quote, aids or abets someone getting an abortion after 6 weeks. That means it opens up doctors, nurses, clinic staff, the Uber driver who drives someone to the clinic, the family member who gives their loved one money, whether or not they know that it's going to go towards abortion care. It could even open up clergy who pastorally counsel and guide their parishioners through these complicated reproductive decisions. Even clergy could be opened up to these lawsuits. And they're civil lawsuits, which means the state is not enforcing this law, but the minimum damages that one can collect is $10,000. So that's what makes SB 8 stand out as particularly draconian, is that anyone anywhere, and you don't have to have a connection to a doctor or a patient or anything. You don't, how does this impact your life? I have no idea. Yeah. But this law is written in a way that anyone can come after anyone in Texas.
While this being passed was pretty much a foregone conclusion, did Just Texas do outreach and education in the summer months leading up to the bill's passage?
I would not say that it was a gone conclusion that SB 8 was going to be passed. We've got a very strong progressive movement for reproductive health rights, justice, and freedom in the state of Texas. And we fought hard, tooth and nail, through the legislative session to prevent this law and the countless others that were also filed. This one just happens to be the one that got through. But yes, our partners and our coalition partners in this were very active over the summer in preparing and figuring out what we were going to do. You know, the reproductive health rights and justice movement is a many pronged movement. So we've got folks doing legal strategy. We've got abortion funds and independent abortion clinics doing the direct support and trying to make sure folks can still access this essential, normal abortion health care. And at Just Texas, we were stepping up and providing support to our abortion clinics, particularly Whole Women's Health, which is an independent abortion provider operating in the state of Texas. We have a designation and initiative called Reproductive Freedom Congregations, where there are 25 congregations across the state that have said they affirm three principles. One, we trust and respect women. Two, we believe that everyone who comes into our congregation will be free from shame, judgment, or stigma for their reproductive decisions, including abortion. And three, we believe that access to comprehensive reproductive health services is a moral and social good. So one of the ways we had these congregations living out those commitments was by sending food and treats and support, coffee, just letting our clinic staff know that the community supported them. Because the unfortunate reality is, there are progressive people of faith who support access to abortion, but we have been silent for far too long. And so for these clinic staff, most of the engagement that they have with a religious community outside of their own personal religious practices is encountering protesters and harassment at the clinic, folks who are yelling at them or are targeting them and can learning all the sorts of invasive information about them. And so it was important for Just Texas that we had congregations showing up in a different way to show there's a different way of being on this issue. There's a different way for people of faith to show up and support this essential, normal abortion health care.
Angela, who's the most immediately impacted by these draconian restrictions on a woman's access to reproductive care?
Yeah. Unfortunately, in the state of Texas, this is only the latest extreme obstacle put up in a series of obstructive bills that have been passed over the past 10 years. So just like all those other restrictions, they impact Black Texans, Indigenous Texans, Texans of color, working class Texans that all need access to abortion care and already live on the margins of our society and already face obstacles to access to health care.
This week, a Texas doctor challenged the new law by performing an abortion after the tiny window currently permitted. He announced what he had done. Predictably, out-of-state parties reacted by suing him. I just don't see how this represents American law and order, Angela.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point. And I think I really want to honor and commend Dr. Braid for stepping up and speaking out and courageously taking a stand and saying, I will continue to provide this healthcare because that is what my call as a doctor is, as a healthcare provider, is to provide compassionate care. What we're seeing in these lawsuits is a really fascinating development. We're still trying to make sense of what exactly is going on, but I have heard that the anti-abortion movement in Texas is not too happy about these lawsuits, which kind of goes to prove the point that we have been making the whole time, that this law is absolutely outrageous and immense overreach into people's personal lives and decisions, because they said this is not what the law was intended to do. Well, yes, even if you take the enforcement of the law out of the hands of the state, it doesn't mean that the enforcement of the law goes straight into the anti-abortion movement's hands. So it will be interesting to see how this plays out. I know that at least one of the plaintiffs has done it to kind of move us forward to calling this law unconstitutional, as it can and as it is. But it will be interesting to see how all of this plays out.
Now, you mentioned the vigilante aspect of this. Talk a little bit more about that. I don't understand it yet.
I don't either, Walter. That is kind of the whole point. And this is what makes it so outrageous is, and my question around, how does this stand up in court? How can anyone anywhere file this lawsuit against anyone who's trying to get someone access to abortion care? How can they prove damages? How do they have standing in the courts? One of the interesting facts about this bill is there is a group in Texas. I don't know the exact name, but they're against frivolous lawsuits that actually backed SB 8. And so if you don't want extraneous, frivolous lawsuits jamming up our legal system, and then you support a bill that opens the floodgates for thousands of frivolous lawsuits, you're right. That does not sound like what our legal system was set up for. It sounds like a big old waste of time and money and resources, which is all just to shut down independent abortion clinics, any abortion clinics, and to prohibit folks from getting access to this essential, normal abortion health care. And we have to remember that this is going to impact women and trans and non-binary people who all need access to abortion. Those are millions of Texans in the state who already, it was hard to find abortion clinics. Most people can travel up to or over 250 miles each way to get to the closest abortion clinic. So this is dangerous. This is just an outright dangerous law. And it really has me questioning who came up with this and why, if it's just going to be a big waste of resources and lead to more death of women and pregnant people. Mm-hmm. Because that's what happens. Yeah. When you ban abortion, folks are still going to access abortion, but it's not going to be safe. Or people are going to be forced to carry pregnancies they don't want to carry. And that can be life-ending in its own way.
Angela, I don't know whether you know or not. I pastored a church in Texas for a while, and that's where I got to know many of the people you're working with. And it's also where I got to know the diversity of the faith communities in Texas. How is that coming out? I know you said you are doing work with them. How is the faith community? Are they fighting each other, or what's happening?
They're not fighting each other, but one thing to know about who gets abortions. One in three women and people who can become pregnant will have an abortion in their reproductive lives, which means one in three people in every single congregation in the state of Texas will have an abortion. Doesn't matter the denomination, doesn't matter the religion. One in three people in pews across this state will have an abortion. And I think some clergy know that. Some clergy have made themselves aware, made themselves available so that their parishioners trust them to say, hey, this is the reproductive decision we're facing right now. And so they know. Others maybe have been really public and folks don't feel safe sharing that part of them mm-hmm. with themselves.
Yeah.
So what I'm seeing in the faith communities in Texas right now is outrage mm-hmm. across the spectrum, across the denominations. It is just, wow, I didn't think it would come to this, and now it's here, and now I have to speak out. Mm-hmm. I'm in a bunch of different clergy groups on social media, and folks are like, I've got to preach on this now. I need to tell my own story. I need to share and speak out and tell about how I've walked with and accompanied someone. I have to be clear that, yes, I've been the one to drive someone to get their abortion. Mm-hmm. And that is the holy sacred work of clergy. And the way that this bill disrupts that calling says, even if I just hold your hand while you make your own decision, then I'm opening myself up to a $10,000 lawsuit. Yeah. It's just absolutely egregious. But folks are speaking up. They are ready. They're ready to speak out. They're ready to act. And they are ready to fight back against this awful unconstitutional bill.
I know this is not the only thing you're working on. What else is on your plate heading into the fall? And remind our listeners how they can support the work of the Texas Freedom Network.
Yeah. So unfortunately, the state of Texas is entering its third special legislative session. And so what Just Texas is working on is bringing together people of faith in support of the trans community. Because once again, we're seeing anti-trans bills be filed to attack trans children who just want to play sports. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that we're focusing on going into the fall. We're going to keep supporting our reproductive freedom congregations. We're going to keep getting new congregations involved and supporting clinics. If you want to get involved in this yourself, research your local abortion clinics, look at Abortion Care Network. That's where you can find independent clinics all over the place, and give to your local abortion funds. The National Network of Abortion Funds is a great resource of folks who are giving the direct support already. And you can learn more about Just Texas at justtx.org. And find all that we're doing in support of LGBTQ equality and reproductive freedom.
Reverend Angela Williams is Senior Outreach and Faith Coordinator at TFN, and their project, Just Texas, Faith Voices for Justice. She's also an ordained Presbyterian pastor and an outspoken person who brings insight and passion in equal measure to her activism. Angela, it's always great to talk with you. I'm glad you could do it this time. I am grateful for you being on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Dalton. It's always good to be here.
On Saturday, October the 2nd, the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding is hosting its annual banquet. For the second year out of public health considerations, it's a gala online event and will include the presentation of this year's Young Scholar Award to Dr. Sama Chowdhury of Ithaca College. Both the event and Dr. Chowdhury's topic are well worth our attention, and so I am very happy to welcome her now to State of Belief Radio. Sama, congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm so honored to be here and to be the recipient of this year's prize.
So your topic is What Makes Humor Muslim? What in the world got you thinking about this?
Yeah. So, you know, my research looks at the ways that Muslims have been constructed through the medium of humor in the contemporary United States. And a lot of people ask me why humor. And we ask this question, but already we implicitly recognize that there is a relationship between Muslims and humor, though perhaps it's less a relationship between Muslims and humor and instead one between Muslims and a lack of humor. So that relationship, especially in the last 40 some odd years, is something that feels and indeed has been made to feel very natural. Muslims are stoic, unfriendly, they're stubborn, quick to fly off the handle when you may offend them. They just can't take a joke. And so there's global flashpoints in our recent history that undergird this assumption, right? Yeah. We have what gets dubbed the Salman Rushdie affair in the 90s. The Danish cartoon controversy in 2005, the Charlie Hebdo shooting in 2015, and the social debates that have always followed these incidents seem to boil down in my mind to two very persistent questions, which is why can't Muslims take a joke? And is Islam therefore compatible with modernity? Hmm. Now, there have been scholars who have taken up this charge, right? Some have argued that you need look no further than the very earliest episodes of Islamic history for proof of Muslim humor, that you can find instances throughout the Quran. There are documented references to the Prophet Muhammad and his companions as lighthearted jokesters, you know, who would mess around with each other, were always laughing, and whose levity would therefore be something that would be emulated by later generations of Muslims. And if it wasn't being emulated, it certainly wasn't because the Prophet himself was not a funny guy. And then there's still others who point to more contemporary emergences of, you know, Muslim comedians, particularly after 9/11, when at least during that time, to laugh and laughter in general became a symbol of freedom and a value of American democracy. Mm. But what I'm trying to articulate through my work is how and why humor, this ability to joke, to take a joke, has actually become a de facto principle of modernity, an admirable personality trait that defines a modern person. And I think without an understanding of how humor and modernity actually come to stand in for one another, what roles gender and race and religion have played in that development, then our discourses are really doomed to continue returning to that same tired premise where Islam is pitted against modernity without any greater comprehension as to why this premise is so naturally assumed at the outset. So that's what I'm trying to do here.
Tell us how what you're seeing about Muslim humor relates to, say, Jewish humor or humor of another group.
Sure. So what I am arguing here is that even though we may assume humor to be a very universal category of communication, I would argue that the way it gets marshaled and demanded of minority communities, including Jewish communities, certainly at the beginning of the 20th century, we saw a lot of this, that this is a mode of secular discourse, and that by speaking it, by embodying it, these minoritized subjects can demonstrate their fitness for modern society, for secular society, despite the, you know, otherwise gendered or racialized meanings that are emanating from their bodies. So the way that Muslims, for example, are spoken of, the way that they're imagined, has become very muddled with the way we talk about race today. Mm-hmm. Much of that has come out of the rampant anti-Muslim hostility and Islamophobia across places like the US, and the need that folks have felt to counter that hostility in the academy, in social justice activism. But this, I'm arguing, has resulted in the use of racial nomenclature as the primary frame through which to understand Muslim identity. So by using this language of, you could call a racial overlay, we are eclipsing religious identities and difference, right? Insisting that they fit into the secular structures and the orders of multiculturalism and diversity that we, you know, hold up as emblematic of the United States. And this is something that other minoritized communities, like I've said, have gone through before. In the early 20th century, there's, you know, a lot of people talk about the Borscht Belt, right? Where Jewish comedians would kind of turn that lens back on themselves, making fun of themselves vis-a-vis the communities that they live in. And that this was a way of indicating not just their Americanness, but their belonging and part in the American social fabric. And I think that's also the effort that's being made by a lot of Muslim comedians. But we want to question that premise and why that need comes about in the first place.
Some personal question. What does it mean to you to receive this recognition, the Young Scholar Award from the Institute?
This is so meaningful to me because it's an opportunity to speak to folks like you about my work. I'm so honored to have been chosen for this award, for the platform that, you know, it's giving me here to think about the things that I'd like to think about, along with a lot more people this time. And so I'm really grateful to the Institute for sharing their platform with me and giving me a space to think out loud with a much bigger audience.
Well, before we go, talk a little bit about the work that you're currently doing at Ithaca College and what you would like to focus on going forward.
Sure. So at Ithaca College, I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religion. Here I'm teaching courses this semester on race and religion, on notions of heaven and hell and afterlife. I've got a great batch of students, and I'm really excited to keep teaching here and to also devote time to my book project, which will be thinking about the things that we just talked about here today, hopefully coming out in a few years, but we'll see where that goes.
Well, you got to let us know when that comes out.
Will do.
Samah Shuthuri is the recipient of the 2021 Young Scholar Award from the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. Dr. Shuthuri will receive her award at the Institute's annual banquet, which is taking place online on Saturday, October the 2nd. Find all the details at ispu.org, and we'll link to the registration page from stateofbelief.com. Samah, congratulations, and thank you so very much for being with us today on such a great topic on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. We would be so grateful. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org and be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what?